Hi, and welcome to another Glenn and Helen podcast. Today we've got James Swanson, the author of Manhunt, the 12-day chase for Lincoln's killer. And it's a pretty interesting story. It's almost a Tom Clancy kind of thriller in a way, except that it's all true.
Yeah, they're even working on a movie starring Harrison Ford as one of the cavalrymen, but we don't even know who's going to play Booth yet.
I'm pulling for Johnny Depp myself, but we'll just have to find out.
Hey, Orlando Bloom might be a possibility.
Well, we'll have to find that out later, but right now we're going to talk to James Swanson and find out a lot about the manhunt, how it fits into American history, how people have managed to revise American history, and what we should think about actors. We're here with James Swanson, author of Manhunt, the 12-day chase for Lincoln's killer. And, you know, John Wilkes Booth seems to be in a sort of different category from other presidential assassins, and maybe it's just because he was a star in real life before he ever became an assassin, unlike the rest, who were mostly kind of puny non-entities. But why and how do you think that the John Wilkes Booth legend differs?
Well, I think it's for a few reasons. One, it was a long time ago. The modern assassinations are in too recent memory for so many of us. John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, all the rest. And I think there are too many Americans who have that in their living memory. And it's something that still upsets people. And the assassins, as you said, were non-entities. They weren't famous people in their own right. It's far too soon, I think, for people to romanticize Lee Harvey Oswald, James Earl Ray, or the rest. And certainly I hope that never happens. But in the case of Booth, first, everyone who remembered the Lincoln assassination is long dead. So the generations that had that in their own experience are long gone. Secondly, Booth, and I think he did this on purpose, he performed the entire assassination. He just didn't kill Lincoln. He staged the entire event like some kind of Shakespearean drama. He killed Lincoln at a theater, kind of breaking the wall, the fourth wall between the audience and the performer. He didn't disguise himself, even though he was one of the most recognizable people in the country, certainly very recognizable in the great cities of New York, Washington, Richmond, and New Orleans. And yet, he jumped to the stage, paused, turned, and faced the audience, and cried out, "Sic Semper Tyrannis," the state motto of Virginia, "the South is avenged." Thus always to tyrants. And then he said, "And the South is avenged." And he was leaving the stage. Some people heard him exult to himself, "I have done it." He performed the entire event. He wanted people to experience it in a way that they would experience a great Shakespearean play or a drama. And so somehow by performing the assassination, he imprinted it partly in people's minds, I think, as a theatrical experience. It was reported that way. He staged his own confrontation with the troops at the Garrett Barn. He engaged them in dialogue and repartee. And the burning barn was like the footlights of the stage, illuminating his performance. So Booth was on a 12-day escape, but he was also on a 12-day performance.
Do you think his narcissism played a part in his willingness to kill Lincoln?
I think so. Booth had a few motives. One, he truly did love the South, and he supported slavery. He hated Lincoln, and yet from the time he was a boy, he had said many times, "Fame, I must have fame." He told his beloved sister, Asia Booth, the gypsy fortune tellers had told him that he would have a great but brief life. The fortune teller prophesied the ways he might or might not die. He always had a sense that he was marked by destiny. And so I think it was a combination of hating Lincoln, supporting slavery, being furious at the fall of Richmond and the burning of Richmond, his desire to possibly change the outcome of the war. Because remember, he had first plotted to kidnap Abraham Lincoln, hold him hostage, and try to sue for peace or get tens of thousands of Confederate prisoners released in exchange for Lincoln. So he had a practical bent, too. He wanted to influence the course of the war. And just because Lee had surrendered on April 9th did not mean the war was over. There were still strong Confederate armies in Texas and North Carolina. Jefferson Davis was still on the run, trying to keep the Confederacy alive. Booth, I think, hoped that the assassination of Lincoln on April 14th, a few days after Lee surrendered on the 9th, might prompt the South or inspire the South to fight on and maybe even stage some kind of guerrilla war. But, of course, it was also Booth's own ego involved.
How were actors viewed in 1865? I know today we have tremendous awe for actors for whatever reason, but I find it interesting. Do you think there is a difference in how they were viewed?
Oh, yes. Well, although they were celebrated and admired, And many witnesses record that both men and women would stop in their tracks when they saw Booth in the street. He was so attractive, so beautifully dressed, so charismatic. Acting was considered a suspect profession. And theaters were considered houses of ill repute. That is one reason why, when Lincoln was shot in a theater and he was laid on the floor of the box, Dr. Leal, the first physician who attended Lincoln, just knew that Lincoln could not be left to die on the floor of this morally illicit landmark, a theater. They had to get him out of that theater. It was just incredible to think that the President of the United States would die on the floor of a theater. It was even worse because it was Good Friday, the most solemn day in the Christian calendar, and it did not go unnoticed by ministers 2 days later in their Easter Sunday sermons that Lincoln was out attending a play on Good Friday instead of being in church. So actors and theaters were celebrated and fascinating to the public, but they were also considered somewhat illicit and morally suspect.
Sort of like Laura Keene when she came in and wanted to hold the president's head, not for reasons of helping, but rather to seal, you know, to get the blood on her dress to sort of show that she was part of this dramatic scene.
Exactly. Laura Keene, I think, has gotten it easy in the history books. And one of the things that's new in my book is my new look at Laura Keene. She's been thought of in other books as the wonderful woman who wanted to comfort the dying president. Well, she fought her way all across the theater, went up a secret staircase, forced herself into the president's box, and asked the doctor if she could lay Lincoln's head in her lap. There was of no possible comfort or medical benefit to Lincoln. He was unconscious from the moment Booth shot him through the head. She did that to immortalize herself, and it worked. We don't remember most of her contemporaries from the 19th century American stage. John Wilkes Booth, of course, maybe Edwin Booth, a few others. But we remember Laura Keene, not because of her wonderful career or her great performances, but because she got in that box and she cradled the dying president's head in her lap. It was just a fantastic scene that she couldn't imagine not being part of, and it worked. We do remember her to this day.
It's kind of a scene-stealing performance worthy of Tallulah Bankhead.
Yes, yes. And the dress became a kind of holy relic in itself. Keene kept the dress, and almost like a Victorian bride preserving the memento of her happiest day or wedding day, Keene kept that dress.
Of course, a lot of people did that, didn't they? I mean, in a sense, turning Lincoln into a kind of a secular saint started that day with people preserving the embalmer drained his blood and saved it in flasks and things like that. It's kind of
creepy. Yes, it is true. While the manhunt for Booth was going on, there was another kind of manhunt going on for blood relics of the Lincoln assassination. Somebody took the wooden bar from a music stand that Booth had used to block the door behind him when he went into the president's box, and that was stained with Major Rathbone's blood when he had to lift that bar up to let the doctors into the box. Well, somebody kept that bloodstained piece of wood. People kept bloodstained pillowcases, fragments from Lincoln's shirt, his cufflinks. The men who took his body away even kept the screws from the wooden box that was used to transport his body from the Peterson house, where Lincoln died, back to the White House. There was an incredible lust for blood relics, locks of Lincoln's hair, locks of Booth's hair. The soldier who slept in the room in which Lincoln died, it was a boarding house, and the soldier was out for the night, came back the next day and slept under the very coverlet on which Lincoln died. And he wrote a letter to his mother in Boston boasting about his collection of blood relics and how people begged to come in and see his room and touch the bed where Lincoln died. It was just a bonanza for relic hunters.
Well, I know people had a somewhat more morbid take on a lot of things back then than they do today. But that is kind of odd. Why do you think the Lincoln assassination and John Wilkes Booth continue to resonate so much today?
Well, for a few reasons. First, it was the first assassination of an American president, and it was the assassination of our greatest president. And it came at a moment of high drama. Lincoln's supreme moment of victory at the end of the Civil War. Just 6 weeks before, he had given the most beautiful inaugural address in the history of the presidency, and he had accomplished what he had promised. He'd preserved the verdict of free elections. He had put down a rebellion. He had saved the Union, just as he promised he would do, and he dealt the death blow to slavery. It was a glorious moment for him. And people saw it in almost religious terms, as though he was a Moses-type figure who had led his people to the promised land but would not be allowed to cross over the river with them. It was the most dramatic week in the history of America, and I think that's the first reason why. Secondly, Booth helped make it that way because of the bizarre and effective way he stage-managed the entire event. It's just unforgettable. It certainly was the most shocking event, a distressing event to Americans since the death of George Washington in 1799. And elderly Washingtonians and Americans could still remember that from their youth, and many of them compared the death of Lincoln to the death of Washington decades before.
You were born on Lincoln's birthday. How did you get so interested in studying this incredible details surrounding his death?
Well, from the time I was a small boy, my parents gave me children's books about Abraham Lincoln. And I got interested that way, but I really got interested when I was 10 years old. And my grandmother, who was a veteran of the long-gone Chicago tabloid newspaper scene and had a wonderful sense of drama, gave me an engraving of Booth's Derringer pistol. And framed with that engraving was part of a clipping from the Chicago Tribune of April 15, 1865, the issue that came out the morning Lincoln died. And that clipping described how Booth got into the president's box, how he shot the president, how he ran out the back door, and then the clipping stopped because it was only part of the page of the newspaper. And I remember being frustrated and saying to myself, you know, when I was 10 years old, I want to read the rest of that story. And that gift from my grandmother was really the trigger that began my obsession with the Lincoln assassination. And years later, when I was working on the Manhunt book, I was lucky enough to find an entire run of about 100 original Chicago Tribunes from the end of the Civil War to the assassination, the death of Booth, and the trial and execution of his conspirators. So years later, I was able to get the actual issue that I read a fragment of when I was 10 years old. And that's really when it began. And then I got much more interested a couple of years later when my parents took us on a family trip to Gettysburg. And my father bought me a Civil War cavalry saber and took me all over the battlefields. And it was that gift from my grandmother and that childhood trip to Gettysburg that really got me going as a Lincoln reader and a collector.
Well, it's really resonating, and I gather there's a movie in the works with Harrison Ford now?
There is. The movie is going to be made by Phil Anschutz's company, Walden Media, which produced The Chronicles of Narnia with Disney, and the movie Holes, and a bunch of other things. And it's being produced by Lawrence Bender, who produced Pulp Fiction and Kill Bill 1 and Kill Bill 2. And the script was by Mike Rich, who wrote Finding Forrester and The Rookie and a number of other good films. And Harrison Ford is cast as one of the detectives pursuing Booth. I don't know who Booth is yet. I just heard yesterday that the film company has apparently made an offer to someone to be Booth, but I don't know who that is.
Seems like the role's made for Johnny Depp.
I think so. There are a number of actors who I think have that look. The interesting thing is to cast Booth, you almost have to find another John Wilkes Booth, someone who has those same characteristics of being magnetic, having these black, piercing eyes. I think there are a few actors who could be great as Booth. One would certainly be Johnny Depp. I think maybe Orlando Bloom would be a great Booth. Will Kemp, Christian Bale, Matthew McConaughey would be a good Booth. He actually looks a bit like Booth. If you look at the eyebrows and the structure of his forehead, he's very Booth-like. I'm sure it'll be someone good, but I want to find that out as soon as I can. I don't want to be in suspense. I want to know who Booth is going
to
be.
I guess the trick is to produce the film without making Booth into a hero.
Yeah, what's interesting is Booth's image kind of went from this evil murderer of to this sort of fascinating anti-hero. When did that happen, do you think, and why?
Well, it started to happen during the manhunt. Some Southerners really loved what Booth did, and there was a private nickname for him that spread in some parts of the South. People called him Our Brutus. And someone in New Orleans even made a piece of tribute sheet music to Booth and named the song Our Brutus. Booth's sister Asia Booth Clark was also instrumental in helping create this legend of her brother. She wrote a secret memoir that was not published until years later. But in that book, she paired Lincoln and Booth, almost claiming that they were destined to end their fates together, and through their deaths, somehow the union was healed and the country was brought together. It was a very clever psychological move on her point. And as part of the reconciliation of North and South, a lot was forgiven. Union soldiers forgave Confederate soldiers. Confederates forgave Unionists. There were always the hard, bitter enders who hated till the end of their lives. But it was very important, I think, to people at the time to bring the Union together. And so they were willing to forget a lot, and also, as an aside, forget the fate of African Americans who were freed during the Civil War. It was an unfortunate pact between North and South that I think let Booth's reputation get a little elevated, and certainly had very harsh treatment for former slaves. And also what contributed to the Booth myth was the fascination of whether he escaped and really got away. Men claimed that they were John Wilkes Booth. There were over 10 false Booths, one who lived in the American West and allegedly committed suicide in 1903. And I think that image of the damned assassin who could find no rest, who escaped Garrett's Farm, who wandered the American West, whose spirit could find no rest, resonated also. And it's interesting, when you go down F Street near Ford's Theater in Washington, during tourist season you can find banners hanging from the lampposts with big portraits of John Wilkes Booth directing visitors to Ford's Theater. People don't give that a second thought. And yet, if you tried to put up a Lee Harvey Oswald banner in Dallas or a James Earl Ray banner in Memphis, it would be outrageous. It would be obscene. And I think that's an example of how Booth is getting away with something.
How does he get away with it and the others don't? What is it that he has that, you know, that the others can't get away with?
Well, I think first he was a grander, more well-known personality. He wasn't a non-entity like Oswald or James Earl Ray. Secondly, so much time has passed that the memories of Lincoln's death have become less bitter, and none of us ever experienced firsthand what it was like to lose Abraham Lincoln. We've only read about it in books. And also, I think the fact that Booth performed the assassination in such a dramatic way, he really made it living theater, and that somehow permeated the popular mind, and people just can't ignore the fact that he did it in such a dramatic way.
If you're a narcissistic actor, you can pretty much get away with anything.
Well, maybe that was true then, and maybe it's true now.
Today.
Certainly, there's something shocking at the new Abraham Lincoln Museum in Springfield, Illinois. When you walk into the main rotunda, there are various wax or synthetic figures of the Lincoln family, of General Grant, General Sherman. Well, standing right in the same rotunda where the Lincoln family is a wax figure of John Wilkes Booth. Now, think how outrageous that is. Imagine if there was a Lee Harvey Oswald figure at the Kennedy Library. It would be insane. And the gift shop at the Lincoln Museum in Springfield even sells plastic toy Derringer pistols. You know, imagine the Kennedy Library selling Mannlicher Carcano toy rifles, or a King Museum selling James Earl Ray rifles. It would just be beyond belief. And yet no one seems to object. And I think the fact that there's a Booth figure in the rotunda of the library in Springfield, that there are Booth banners hanging in the streets of Washington, shows in part how Booth is getting a bit of the last laugh.
It's funny, my favorite Booth quote in your book is actually one that he said to one of his female admirers. He said, "Go home and beware of actors. They are to be seen, not to be known." And I guess some things don't change.
Well, no. In fact, I've read that line to a couple actor friends. And they said, "He's so right." That could be true of actors throughout history, from ancient Greek times to the modern day. But, of course, the footnote to that warning that Booth gave that young woman, she didn't care. She invited Booth to seduce her anyway, even though he had warned her what he was and how he would treat her.
But don't you think that's really attractive to women?
I won't speculate on
that. Okay.
I will only say that Booth was just a voluptuous connoisseur of young women. And it's so interesting to me that when he was killed at the Garrett Farm, photos of five of his favorite girlfriends were found on his body.
Could you tell us about the capture there at the barn? What actually, just tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, Booth had spent a couple days at a place called the Garrett Farm near Port Royal, Virginia. Booth was essentially heading south and southwest. And when he got to the Rappahannock River, he crossed from Port Conway over to Port Royal in a small ferry. And by then he had met up with three Confederate veterans who helped guide him on his way. At first they didn't know who he was, but then he revealed himself. And Booth was traveling with one of his co-conspirators, David Harold. The Confederates took him to a farm owned by a man named Richard Garrett. And they said, well, here's a wounded Confederate soldier. Can you care for him? So Booth stayed and rested at that farm. In the meantime, a tip had come back to Washington that Booth had been seen in that vicinity. So a contingent of the 16th New York Cavalry, led by an officer named Doherty, and also led by two detectives, Conger and Baker, got aboard a ferry boat in Washington and steamed down towards the direction of Port Royal. And so what took a journey that took Booth 12 days took the cavalry only hours on this steamer. In the middle of the night, they rode right past the Garrett Farm where Booth was hiding. They didn't know he was there. They went to a town farther south, Bowling Green. And they captured one of these young Confederates who had taken Booth to the farm, and they threatened him with death unless he would take them to where Booth was hiding. So he led them back. In the middle of the night, the soldiers swept into the farm, surrounded the house, brought out the old man and his family, and said, where are those men? The old man obfuscated, so the soldiers got a rope and said, we're just going to hang you right now. But then the two sons of Mr. Garrett said, we'll tell you where he is. He's in that tobacco barn. Booth was trapped. He had heard the cavalry arrive, and he and David Harold tried to get out the front door. But the two Garrett sons, even though they were former Confederates, had locked Booth and Harold in the barn, not because he was Lincoln's assassin, but because they thought he was some sort of thief who would steal their horses in the middle of the night. Then Booth and Harold ran to the back of the barn and tried to kick the boards out, but they couldn't. Then the soldiers surrounded the barn. And by then, I think Booth knew he was finished, but the question was, how would it finish?
But the soldiers didn't go in after Booth, did they?
No, they didn't. That's one of the most curious things. Certainly, Secretary of War Stanton wanted Booth alive. He had to have him alive because everybody believed, with some legitimacy, that Booth was an agent or cat's paw of the Confederacy. Newspapers called Booth the emissary of the slave power. They wanted Booth alive so that Booth could testify that he was sent by Jefferson Davis of the Confederate Secret Service, of the Confederate High Command. They were sure that there was a higher involvement in this plot, and the only way they were going to find that out was to capture Booth alive. So the soldiers were not sent there to kill Booth. They wanted to take him. And yet, after David Harold surrendered, he didn't want to die. He knew the soldiers were going to set the barn on fire. Booth allowed David Harold to leave the barn, and then Booth was alone, armed with two six-shot revolvers and a repeating Spencer carbine and a knife. He was on one crutch because he had broken his leg in his jump from Lincoln's box to the stage at Ford's Theater. And then instead of simply rushing the barn, they had 26 soldiers and two detectives and one officer. They started to parley with Booth and engage him in negotiations. This went on for an hour or two. Booth did an impromptu performance. He said, Captain, I can see you out there. The barn was a tobacco drying barn, so there were spaces between the vertical slats of the boards to let air pass through, so Booth could see what was going on outside. He said, Captain, I see you holding that candle. I could have shot you by now if I wanted. Come, I'll fight you one by one. Booth was challenging 26 men to individual combat, like he was a knight in an old English play. And they said, no, we want you to surrender. And Booth said, give me some time to think about it. And the officer said, oh, okay. So they left Booth in there for 15 or 20 minutes while he thought about what he was going to do. Then they thought they might set the barn on fire. So they forced the Garrett sons to start piling brush against the barn. Well, Booth heard that, and he rushed to the side of the barn, and dramatically he said, young man, I advise you not to come back here, or I'll have to shoot you. To the end, he was trying to do some sort of staged gentleman performance. And then Booth said, come, let me die like a gentleman. I'll fight you all. And finally, the soldiers decided they had to do something. But I think maybe what they should have done instead of set the barn on fire, why didn't they just rush the barn? You know, a Confederate army rushed the Union lines at Gettysburg on the third day of Pickett's charge. Union regiments stormed Mary's Heights at Fredericksburg in December 1862 and suffered heavy casualties. It's a mystery why 26 men under the command of three detectives and officers didn't just rush that barn and try to take Booth alive. Yes, Booth might have shot one or two or three or four of them, but by then they would have taken him. It was a strange kind of passivity. The officers were disagreeing on what to do. Should they burn the barn now or wait till the morning? But in the morning, the light would show where all the soldiers were, and Booth could snipe at them with his Spencer carbine, a very accurate rifled weapon. It was almost a Keystone Cops kind of operation. And that's something new that I try to do in the book. Most of the other accounts just describe, in a matter of fact, how the 16th New York Cavalry came there. They set the barn on fire, and Booth was shot and killed by a soldier who probably shouldn't have fired. But I speculate on why this happened. Why was it so mishandled? And I tried to look at the whole events, at the whole series of events at Garrett's farm in a fresh way that hasn't been written this way before.
Could there be any that they were so in awe of him and what he had done and how much he'd gotten away with that they had a hard time?
I don't know. I just don't know what it was. Mm-hmm. It was a divided command, and the officers were bickering over what to do. The officers had failed to issue explicit orders to their men, do not fire. They didn't order the men to fire or not fire.
Mm-hmm.
And then, when Booth was illuminated by the flames, one soldier, a very strange eccentric character named Boston Corbett, was peeking through the barn, slap, and he saw Booth start to raise his carbine, and he shot him. He said he did it because he feared that Booth was going to raise that carbine and open fire and kill one of the soldiers. And then when his officers questioned him, why did you do that? He said, Providence directed my hand. Boston Corbett was a very strange figure. Before the war, his devotion to his faith was so extreme that when he was tempted by what he called fallen women, he castrated himself with a pair of scissors and then went out for a hearty dinner. He did need emergency medical treatment after that. He was known as a honorable, hard-fighting soldier. But after all the events at Garrett's farm were over, one of the officers did say, even though he had a good reputation among his men, there was something strange in his eyes.
Go figure. Well, you know, one of the things you mentioned were these suspicions that this was a higher-level Confederate plot, and I know there's been a certain amount of disagreement on that question among historians. What's your take?
Well, I'm absolutely convinced that Jefferson Davis and the high leadership of the Confederacy did not order the assassination of Lincoln. Yes, there were some Confederate Secret Service plots during the war against the Union to burn New York City to the ground, to introduce yellow fever and contagion to New York City and Washington, D.C. and other places, to possibly kill Lincoln by sending him a trunk of clothes masquerading as a gift, but the clothes were to be infected with yellow fever. The Confederate Secret Service did engage in some wild plots, and John Wilkes Booth certainly went to Montreal, Canada, met with Confederate agents there, and got their help with respect to his plan to kidnap Abraham Lincoln and take him south. It's from these agents that Booth, for example, got the name of Dr. Mudd, who treated his leg. But there's a lot of difference between some officers at the lower level conspiring with Booth than it being an official act of the Confederate government. No evidence has ever surfaced.
Well, and as you note in the book, during the war, it would have been quite easy to assassinate Lincoln because he would just meet with people who walked in from the street and wanted to meet with him with no security.
Yes, he was completely vulnerable in the White House. You or I could have gone to the White House any time, walked in the front door, we wouldn't have been stopped. We could have walked right into the White House. And we would have told one of the Lincoln's private secretaries, he only had two or three at a time, which is interesting. You know, the executive office of the president now, I believe, has between 1,000 and 2,000 employees. Lincoln had two or three. Anyway, then one of the secretaries would say, what's your business? And all you'd have to say is, well, I want to see the president. And you'd often be told, well, sit on that bench. He's busy now. It might take a couple hours. Yes, Lincoln was very vulnerable, and yet no one went into the Oval Office to challenge him or assassinate him. Also, some Johnson, the vice president, had been involved, and even worse, the Secretary of War Stanton, who Lincoln loved, and Stanton loved Lincoln, his right hand during the Civil War, was involved in the plot. That was completely false, completely malicious, no shred of truth in that. And yet, when people ask me about this book, one of the things they always ask about is, was there a government plot on the Union side to kill Lincoln? Wasn't Stanton involved? That's probably the most enduring myth of the Lincoln assassination, that somehow Secretary of War Stanton and other Union leaders were involved. And whenever I'm asked about it, I just try to tamp that down immediately, because it is entirely false. There is no evidence of it whatsoever. It's just a lie.
The other persistent rumor you mentioned in the book is the somewhat successful effort of Dr. Mudd's family to rehabilitate his reputation and cast him as an innocent doctor who didn't know who he was treating, but was just following his Hippocratic oath. And they even managed to get a Hollywood film with that theme.
Yes, Dr. Mudd was a lucky man. He barely escaped hanging in July 1865 with Booth's four conspirators who were hanged. And perhaps Dr. Mudd should have been hanged. His first story was that a stranger came to his door in the middle of the night and said he had a broken leg. He treated the leg. The man stayed a few hours, and then he went on his way, and he had no idea who it was. Well, in fact, Booth had gotten Dr. Mudd's name from Confederate agents in Canada. He had met Booth. Mudd had met Booth on three prior occasions. In the past, Booth had spent the night at Mudd's home. Mudd took him shopping for horses. He met him at other locations, at a church near Mudd's house. When John Wilkes Booth arrived at Dr. Mudd's farm in the middle of the night, when he shot Lincoln, Mudd knew exactly who Booth was from the moment Booth walked in his front door. Secondly, Booth stayed at Mudd's house longer than Mudd told the detectives a few days later. And when Booth left Mudd's farm early on the morning of April 15th, Mudd waited days to report that a stranger had been there. He wanted to give Booth a head start. And years later, Mudd had been sentenced to life in prison at the conspiracy trial of May through July 1865. Andrew Johnson pardoned him in 1869, along with the other surviving conspirators. Years later, Mudd confessed to another one involved in helping Booth. I knew who it was all along. And after Mudd's death, Mudd's own lawyer said that Mudd was guilty. He lied to us. He lied to everyone. He knew who Booth was. And Mudd's family has done a wonderful propaganda job of creating the myth of the innocent country doctor who had no idea that the assassin of Lincoln was at his home, no idea that it was John Wilkes Booth, and that he was a complete victim, innocent victim of a vengeful government. Well, that story is false. And now historians have really targeted Mudd, and now it's really accepted that there's much more to the Mudd story than the Mudd family lets on, or that Dr. Mudd claimed in his defense. I'm convinced that Mudd was a part of Booth's plot to kidnap Abraham Lincoln, that Mudd may have not known that Booth was planning to kill Lincoln, and when Booth arrived at Mudd's farm, there's a chance that he didn't immediately tell Mudd that he killed Lincoln. But certainly, Mudd was involved with Booth's conspiracy against Lincoln to kidnap him. He knew it was Booth in his house. He delayed telling the authorities. He knew a lot more. And furthermore, if you're part of a plot to kidnap the President of the United States, and without your knowledge, that plot morphs into murder, you're not innocent.
No, you're definitely not.
Is that what happened with Mary Soot, who was involved?
Well, Mary Surratt is an interesting case, too. Mary Surratt was a 42-year-old widow who had a boarding house in Washington and a country tavern about 12 or 14 miles outside of Washington. And her son, John Surratt, was one of Booth's closest conspirators. John Surratt was a Confederate courier making journeys from Richmond to New York City and upstate New York and to Canada. And John Surratt had met Jefferson Davis. He knew a lot of the Confederate hierarchy. Mary got to know John Wilkes Booth because Booth would call at her boarding house in Washington, which is now a Chinese restaurant in Washington, D.C.'s Chinatown. And Booth got to know the family, and some of the conspirators would come to this house. I believe that Mary Surratt knew that Booth and her son were involved in a conspiracy to kidnap the president. On the day of the assassination, Booth stopped at Mary Surratt's boarding house in Washington. And by that time, Booth had already decided he would attempt to kill Lincoln that night. And he visited with Mary Surratt alone in her parlor. Then, she got in her carriage and rode out of the city and went to her country tavern with Booth's binoculars, wrapped in a piece of newspaper bound with twine. And she gave them to the tavern keeper and said someone would call for these. And then she said to the tavern keeper, a man named John Lloyd, "Get those shooting irons ready. There'll be parties here tonight who will call for them." Booth's conspirators had stashed two repeating Spencer carbines at Mary Surratt's country tavern. And they planned to stop there after the assassination, pick up the carbines, pick up some whiskey, pick up rope, and pick up these field glasses. Then, after she accomplished that mission, Mary Surratt rode back to Washington, and she was sitting in her boarding house writing a letter when Booth assassinated Lincoln. I don't know if Booth told her that he was going to kill Lincoln that night.
Yet she got, a very horrible punishment. Obviously, she was hanged with the rest of the conspirators, and I thought it was interesting that they ended up, killing a woman at that point. And
yes, well, it was done for two reasons. Vice President Johnson had said she kept the nest that hatched mm-hmm. the egg of the conspiracy and the murder. And secondly, the authorities were most frustrated that they couldn't capture her son, John Surratt. That's who they really wanted. The night Lincoln was assassinated, John Surratt was in Elmira, New York, spying on a Confederate prisoner of war camp as part of a plot to free the prisoners there. When he heard that Lincoln was assassinated, he fled the country to Canada, where he was hidden by Catholic priests, and then ultimately spirited away to Europe, where he joined the Papal Bobs and was not captured by the United States until a couple of years later. There was tremendous frustration that John Surratt had escaped. Initially, it was even thought that he might have been the assassin who almost stabbed Secretary of State Seward to death in his bed while Booth was shooting Lincoln. I think that if John Surratt had been captured, or if he had surrendered himself when he knew that his mother was on trial for 2 months for his life, I think Mary Surratt would have been spared.
Mm-hmm.
But in John Surratt's absence, all they had was her. And so she was sentenced to death along with three others, and she was hanged.
And at a later point, wasn't he tried? John Surratt, wasn't he tried?
Yes, he was brought. He was captured and brought back to America, and he was tried before a civil court in Washington, D.C. The Booth's other conspirators were tried by a military tribunal in 1865, almost immediately after Lincoln's assassination.
And tried by a military tribunal and not a civilian court?
That's right. But John Surratt was brought back after the Civil War was over, and he was tried by a civil court. It produced a tremendous transcript of over almost 1,400 printed in small type pages, but the jury was deadlocked.
Mm-hmm.
John Surratt was released. He was indicted again, and then that indictment was dropped, and he emerged as a free man, although with a damaged reputation. He was widely defiled as a coward who had left his mother to die, but he wouldn't let it go. In 1870, just 5 years after the assassination, he attempted to profit from the murder of Lincoln by giving public lectures. And he gave lectures in New York City at Cooper Union, where Lincoln had given his great Cooper Union speech of February 1860 that really catapulted him to the presidency. He gave a lecture in Rockville, Maryland that was very well received. Maryland was very pro-Confederate territory, even though it had not left the Union. And then he had the audacity to attempt to give a lecture on December 30th, 1870 in Washington, D.C. at the Odd Fellows Hall, just a few blocks from Ford's Theater. And a few blocks from his mother's boarding house.
But apparently this works, and I suppose people think it's better to live as a coward than die as a hero?
Well, I think that's what he chose. And, right. And what I find fantastic is he boasted about his deeds. He had a big poster printed talking about his thrilling exploits of the war, his intimate association with Booth, the plot to kidnap the president. It was just too much.
So this is a whole group of kind of bipolar sort of
I don't know what he was.
But, no, I'm kidding.
But it was too much. Yeah. And citizens of Washington were just outraged, and he was threatened. And his poster even says, "All reports to the contrary notwithstanding, John Surratt will deliver his lecture." Well, he didn't. He was found hiding, fearful, in a hotel room, and he never gave that lecture in Washington, and he never lectured again.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's a fascinating story. We've actually run a little bit over time here because it was just so interesting.
Very interesting.
Thanks so much.
That's the beauty of podcasting. You know, we don't have to stop in time for the car commercials.
That's great.
But thanks so much, and I think people are really going to enjoy your book, Manhunt, The 12-Day Chase for Lincoln's Killer, and I know we did.
Oh, well, thanks for having me join you.
Thank you very much.
Well, ladies, maybe you ought to take John Wilkes Booth's advice and stay away from actors.
They do seem an unsavory lot, even when they're not shooting presidents sometimes. But that's really a fascinating story, and the book really moves. I mean, it's more than just a work of history. It really does read like a thriller.
It really does. Typically, it's not something I'd be interested in, but when I picked up the book and started reading, I couldn't put it down. It's a great book.
Well, John Wilkes Booth is just another one of your narcissistic killers. You're always reading about them.
Yeah, it's just another busman's holiday for me.
Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll be back whenever we're ready. You can check our websites at instapundit.com or drhelen.blogspot.com for updates. You can also subscribe via iTunes, where we're currently one of the top 10 talk radio podcasts. Still way behind Howard Stern, though. And you can also subscribe via podcast at Yahoo, Podcast Alley, and a variety of other services. We'll talk to you another time, and until then, have fun on the Internet.
Talk to you next time.